Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them into his vineyard. When he went out about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and he said to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and I will pay whatever is right." So they went. When he went out again about noon, and about 3 o'clock, he did the same. About 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, "Why are you standing here idle all day?" They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers, give them their pay, beginning with the last, then going to the first." When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now when the first came, they thought that they could receive more, but each of them also received the usual daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be first, and the first will be last.
Things unseen won't cripple me. I place my hope in you. This deep desire, longing out, I'm falling into you. Love isn't always was a longing placed inside my heart to know you and be known by you.
Most of the readings of this parable look very, very similar. They start out by focusing that the landowner is God and the landowner is generous. And that's what this story is fundamentally about. The people, the laborers, the ones who start early in the day and come late into the evening and they work in the vineyard, well, that's us. They're the grumbling workers. And that's the juxtaposition that we try to hold. Like, are we the grumbling workers? And if we are the grumbling workers, are we the one that got there early in the morning and have worked all day? And then look at someone else who arrived just 30 minutes ago, and then we see them get paid what we do, and then we get upset. Or are we the ones who are feeling like we never actually get called to the field to work, and then just like, thank God we got paid what everybody else got paid all day long. What a gift. Depending on where you fall in this, it's a very different story, but I was pretty certain as I started that that reading is really persuasive. It's really powerful to me. Those early arriving laborers. See, they want to believe that the landowner should see their work, their day's work, as more valuable than the people who just got on the scene. They just came out into the vineyard like an hour ago or 3 hours ago. But God, in this case, makes something very clear. The people who just came to work at the end of the day are just as valuable as those who've been there all along. The landowner pays them the same. In an economic sense, this is crazy making. But in a divine sense, this just might be the way that grace actually works. You know, we think about this denarius, and it's like it's a day's wage for subsistence folks. And so surely the people who'd been working all day, if somebody that just worked for an hour was fortunate enough to get a day's wage for a subsistence liver, or a subsistence living, surely the people that have been working all day deserve even more money. But God says, you know what? The landowner says, you know what? All means all. My grace is sufficient for all of you, and it's equal upon all of you, whether you've been here laboring all day or not. And I don't like this part, but God's bookkeeping doesn't look like my bookkeeping. That's just how it is. But then I started to wonder more as I continued to read and hold this parable. What if the moment of grace in this story isn't about the ending where everyone gets paid equally, but what if it's about God's invitation out to the field? What if I was misreading the emphasis and really it was about God inviting those people? See, what if God is going out and saying, come and move away from your idle ways and find some purpose? That's God's invitational power. Come out into the vineyard and be part of creating with me the kingdom or the kingdom of God. See, God's just like that landowner who longs for us to go out into the vineyard and to be part of the harvest. And the power of grace then is in that invitation to give purpose to our idle ways. See, a lot of people love to read this, maybe sometimes myself included, that the people who came to work in the vineyard at the end of the day, well, they were lazier than I am. I would have been the person that was there early in the morning, like ready to go. But there's nothing in the text that's actually says that these people were any better or lazier than anyone else. They simply were unwanted laborers. No one wanted them. And God found a purpose for them and called them out into the vineyard to work. So who are some of those people in Jesus's day who would have been there working as those laborers? Well, the ones who would come last, the ones who would get hired last, we can assume that those are folks that are infirm and weak. Maybe persons with disabilities. Maybe people who were too elderly to keep a sustainable job going. But it makes me wonder, who are those folks today? Who are the folks that are at Home Depot right now that'll be the last ones to get hired if they get hired today? Or who are the folks that are in our midst who are underemployed, that are working what should be a wage to sustain them, but they never quite make it? No matter how many hours they pull, the overtime never actually adds up. See, in this parable, God turns that upside down and says the first will be last and the last will be first. Elizabeth Schuessler-Fiorenza, she describes it this way. The disciples are a discipleship of equals, yet they keep screwing it up. Maybe like we keep screwing it up. They keep wanting to know, but which of us is the greatest? It's got to be me. I gave up everyone. I gave up everything I had to come and follow you. I was the first one. Okay, fine. I was the third, but I was really close. I'm way better than the person that was 37th. They've hardly been here at all. And in the world's terms, that makes sense. The first are first. The last are last. I think it was Miguel Cabrera that signed that contract today. The first are first, right? The guy's making more money than... You're not going to say he's last. He's definitely not going to say that. Well, in God's grace, the first are paid last, and the last are paid first. And the grace turns everything upside down so that they're all equal. These are some of the characters in this story. First, we have the landowner, and the manager, the laborers that are hired early in the morning, those hired at 9 and at noon, at 3 and at 5. And where we see ourselves in this story is going to determine how we see the story and maybe how we see ourselves, period. So I want to confess that more often than not, I probably see myself as the one that's hired early in the morning. I like to think I work really hard and I've got everything figured out. And when I look around at my colleagues, I think they don't work as hard as I do. She got here at noon. She did beat me here this morning. That's true. I confess, that's true. And so next week, I'll try to get here even earlier. But that's how I tend to work. And if someone who came in very late in the day was recognized equally, I would be hurt by that. I would be upset by that. I'd be thrown off by that. So I wonder where you might find yourself in this. Maybe you resonate with some of what I shared, or maybe you're that person that's feeling unwanted and feels like you haven't been hired until late in the day, or maybe you're one that didn't even make it into the parable, the one that didn't even get hired. That's a lot of the folks that came into our space last night from Winter Sanctuary, folks that are waiting for something, and that something is not happening for them. Where we see ourselves in this story matters. But this series, we're trying to figure out how we give up certainty. And so what I wonder is if I've made some assumptions in the readings that I've already shared, readings that I really love, readings that say, you know what, as much as we grumble about things, God's unconditional love invites us to have purpose. That is a powerful message. But what if even in that reading, I've made some assumptions and assumed some certainties that aren't really there? So we're going to look at that for a little while together this morning. Before we do, I want to remind us that it can be really uncomfortable to let go of some of those certainties. But I think that we need to be able to do that so that we can allow ourselves to be open to how God might be helping us to see a new thing in this moment, in this time. We've been doing that for the last couple of weeks. We began the series with Linda's message on the parable of the leaven. She challenged us to see that God's love is mixed up in this lump of our existence as leaven, and somehow it lightens everything in our midst. And then Sarah, our seminary intern who's away this week, she deconstructed the parable of weeds and wheat to help us see that the weeds and wheat are all inside of us, as little as we like to acknowledge that at times. And last week, Linda reflected on the parable of the bridesmaids, and I'm told that she did it in a really short, succinct way. See, I really think I'm the person that gets there first in the morning, no matter what. always. She helped us to see that no matter how prepared we are, we can never be prepared enough. But we're in this together, and the bridegroom, though late, is arriving. So a few weeks ago, Becca Kramer shared this book with me. It's called Parables as Subversive Speech by William Herzog. And it pulled any rug of certainty I had for myself completely out from under me this week as I started to read the parable of the vineyard again through the eyes of Herzog. And so I want to share with you some of the ways that Herzog helped me to think anew, to take apart some of my certainties and to think anew about this parable. So first is, the first person to arrive on the scene in the parable of the vineyard is the landowner. And every reading of this parable that I've shared so far, and most readings that you'll find out there, they make a huge assumption. Well, the landowner is God. And then you just keep reading and everything falls into place. And you could focus on the equality of the message at the end or the invitational power of the landlord, but either way, the landlord is God. But what if we let go of that assumption? And Herzog and many, many others would say that not only should we let go of that, but Jesus intended this story to be read entirely different than we've been imagining it. Because Jesus wasn't talking about the landlord as God. Jesus wasn't exposing a system of oppression that had been crushing people. And if we were alive in Jesus' day, we would have heard this message entirely differently. We wouldn't have gone first to think of Jesus, the landowner, as God. We would have thought of the landowner as a landowner, a wealthy landowner. That's actually what the story says. And that's what turns everything upside down. So first, we need to understand a little bit more about landowners in Jesus' day. And the first thing is this, that no elite landowner would go to the marketplace himself, and to be clear, it would have been a man. He would not go himself to the market to hire people. He had people to hire people for him. He would stay at home and trust that the people he had hired to do that would do it. And so there's some weirdness in this story, because the landowner who has enough wealth to have a manager working for him goes to the marketplace. Well, that's weird. So let's just hold that. But the story tells us that the landowner has a manager. So we can assume if the landowner is wealthy enough to have a manager, that he has lots of peasants who work for him. Lots of people who are expendable around him that do all of that work. Those are some of his truths, some of the places where he is. We can assume even more because it's a landowner of a vineyard. And we're close to Napa and Sonoma, so we know well what you produce in a vineyard is wine. And wine is something that you can market and sell. It's not just going to the people right around you, but it's going to make you a lot more money. It's a luxury item. So this is a landowner who has a manager and also has a vineyard that makes something fancy that people are going to pay money for. That's who this person is. We also know that this person goes there, the landowner goes many times to the marketplace to hire people. Well, that's kind of strange too. He clearly doesn't know enough about his own harvest to know how many people he should have hired. He could have just hired them all early in the morning and been done with it. But he keeps going back. So either this landowner isn't the brightest kid on the block, or the harvest is more imaginable than he even dreamed. And he's got to go find people because he needs the harvest to come in right now. What we know is that every single time he goes there, he sees lots of people. So we know it's not unlike our day, maybe even worse. There are unemployed folks all around this landowner. Those are some of the things that we know about him. We also know that after the first hire, every time he goes back to hire other people, there's no negotiating. He says, come and work in the field, I'll pay you what is right. He doesn't mean I'll pay you whatever you think is right, why don't you pick? He means I'll pay you what I think is right. That's how landowners work. It's why we have people like Greg and Bev who work in this area to advocate for labor rights. And they would throw things upside down. I know Bev would. I'm pretty confident Greg would too, actually. So these folks who are laborers, they don't have their activists that are there to speak out, to help them speak out on their behalf. We just have folks that are there waiting for this landowner to tell them to go out into the field to give them that work. So let's look for a moment at who these laborers might be. Who are these folks who are laboring out in the field? So first of all, these are folks who are uprooted, and hunger is driving them to work for that day out in the field at harvest and at planting time. studies of this time period help us to understand that people who are day laborers are dependent on the wealth of others around them. So they get to work a couple times a year at planting and at harvest. And beyond that, they're going to journey from city to city, and they're going to ask for handouts from folks that have more than they do. These are the people that are there. These are their day laborers. You can imagine who these day laborers are in our time. So, those uprooted laborers who've been working all day, they witness someone who came on the scene to work in the vineyard just for the last hour, and they see that person paid what they agreed to early in the morning. And they think, first, this person's getting paid before me. And second, they're getting paid what I agreed to. So one, either I'm going to get more, or this is an unfair system. This is an unfair system. So they say in verse 12, these last worked only 1 hour, and you've made them equal to us, who've borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. See, they're complaining because they've been shamed. They've been shamed by a landowner who, it seems pretty clear, if you don't assume that the landowner is God, you assume the landowner is a landowner, but that's a deliberate insult. And so they react to it, as I hope every one of us would. By reversing the order of payment so that the last hired receive a wage equal to that of the first, the landowner has essentially told them that their day-long efforts of work don't matter to him. It's really worth no more to me than the people I went out 30 minutes ago and said, why don't you finish the job? And then he does something even bigger to me. He essentially looks to them then and says something like this. Well, actually, he doesn't look to them. He says, manager, you go tell them. Isn't that how it always works? Like, the person at the top doesn't tell the person at the bottom. You go tell them. That's how systems of oppression, like work, they suck us in, and then we become the one who's that middle person doing the injustice to someone else because we see that there's no other possible way. It's the system that we live in, and it uses the word friend. But it doesn't mean like friend, like we're equals in this. He replies friend in this condescending and subtle way to reinforce the different social status, like friend. Oh, friend. Don't you understand that the landowner is actually just being really nice to give you any money at all? It's what you agreed to. It's equal to the other person. Don't you understand that you should just be happy because you haven't earned this, really? It's out of his generosity that he's giving it to you. And that's what happens, right? It's not actually about an exchange for labor. It becomes that this landowner is now just like a gracious, charitable person. And isn't that how wealth and poverty often sit together sometimes? Isn't that how more often than not we find ourselves like, I'm choosing to do this out of charity. And it robs all of those laborers who've been there since early in the morning of any dignity that they might have had. And they're also in an impossible place, because what happens next? Well, the landowner finds one of them to make an example of. That one speaks out and says, this is not fair. This is not fair. And so the landowner banishes that person. This is no like beautiful, sweet, go in peace. No, this is a you will not work here or anywhere else, full stop. Goodbye. That's what the landowner has the power to say and to do. And what's the person supposed to do who's been laboring there all day? And then what's anybody else supposed to do? Because what the story exposes, what Jesus' parables expose, are the systems of oppression that we find ourselves in. And then say, we're in this together. God longs for us to find a third way. God needs us to see that whether you're the person sitting there that came in at noon or at 3, or you're the one speaking out who's been there early in the morning, if we're not in this together, that person gets banished, and then we all have no voice. Because guess what? Whoever speaks up next, the same thing is going to happen to them. We're either all in it together, or we're all alone. And I wonder if that is what Jesus' parable wanted to expose. Just how messy this all is. What if that is what the kingdom of heaven is like? It's like exposing the madness of the world and just calling it like it is. What if Jesus longed for people to hear this and then to respond? To rise up is one of the songs that Dave will, he's not going to share it next week, but one that he sings. What if these uprooted laborers, these fledgling disciples, what if they could see that that was their call, that was their invitation? And so then I wonder what kind of oppression operates in our day. If that was Jesus' parable for his day, what does it look like for us? How do we stand with others in solidarity amidst that kind of complexity? So some of you might have heard earlier this week a lot about world vision. First, I want to know if I'm the only, anyone heard about world vision? Some folks heard about world vision. I want to share briefly a little bit about this. World Vision is a prominent evangelical Christian organization that does a lot of work around the world in hopes of eradicating and working to alleviate folks who live in poverty. And one of the main ways they do that is through sponsorships. So you can sponsor a child through World Vision, and then you get this little thing that goes on your refrigerator, and it's kind of a reminder of that person, and the money that you give goes directly to help this person in need in another place. World Vision is huge. It's they have 1,100 people that work at their Seattle office. So they announced earlier in the week that they were going to allow people who are gay and lesbian to work in their organization. They were going to allow folks who are lesbian and gay and married to work in their organization. They'd been working on this for a while. As many of you know, in Washington, gay marriage became legal, so they were trying to figure out how to navigate this. And within 2 days of doing that, they had almost 5,000 people call them and say, we are no longer going to sponsor the child that we were with because you're going to hire gay and lesbian people, and in their language, they would say that that's against, I want to be as fair as I can. They would say that's against the will of God, something to that effect. And so all of that happened, and then 2 days later, World Vision reversed course. And World Vision said, we made a mistake. Oops. We didn't mean to do that. We made a mistake. We are not going to have an inclusive policy. We're not going to hire openly gay and lesbian people. So they renounced the turn that they'd made. There's a person on a blog called Pathos, Benjamin Corey, wrote a really beautiful, reflective piece about this, in which he argues that mainstream evangelicals made an alliance with fundamentalist evangelicals those 2 days to say together that, like, this is a non-negotiable issue. And anything that hints of same-sex marriage or anything that hints around it, it's not okay. It's not okay. So we have to come together on this. And I want to be really clear, and Benjamin makes this point really well. This isn't even actually about same-sex marriage. This was a debate about whether or not you could hire someone who's gay or lesbian. So it upped the ante even more. It used to just be that, like, to be gay was bad. And then it's to marry gay people is bad. Now it's to hire gay people. God is against, in their framework, against all of this, and it just keeps escalating itself. keeps going, the system does, in those ways. He writes it this way: it was declared that evangelicals are not allowed to take a neutral position on the issue. That's the key. No more neutrality. Hiring a married gay person shall now be considered as equally egregious to officiating their wedding yourself or to being gay. So the executive director of World Vision, his name is Rick Stearns. I heard him speak a couple weeks back. He was asked this question: do you have employees or members of the board who are worried about being perceived as anti-gay? And he had the audacity to say this: certainly that would be a concern. I certainly don't want to send a message to the gay community that we're anti-gay. We're not. We are pro-people. I don't know what that means, but we're pro-people. We believe that all people are created in the image of God and are to be treated with love and respect. That's the foundation to our work around the world. We would not want people to think that we have negative attitudes toward people with same-sex orientation. The whole week, this week, exposed, maybe like Jesus' parable, the utter fallacy of that statement. It just exposed how untrue that really is. Here are a couple of the pieces that happened on Twitter from the side who was wanting World Vision to renounce its position of inclusivity and become anti-gay again. We should welcome this statement of repentance and humility. World Vision never should have waded into these waters. It's a brilliant, interesting statement to me. We never should have waded into this, because if we didn't actually open it up and look at it, we would never have to deal with the fact that World Vision has a policy that's anti-gay. We shouldn't talk about these things. Don't talk about that. Jesus never should have told the parable about a landowner and a vineyard and the vineyard laborers, because you know what? It's better off if we don't expose the system, we just let it keep going. And we don't have to look at it. Don't wade into those waters. Nadia Bolz-Weber, she writes under Sarcastic Luther, she wrote, one step forward, two steps back. See, she was in the tough position because she is a more progressive evangelical who, what she did, as soon as World Vision made this announcement, she said, so let's gather our people to go sponsor children at World Vision. So she did that. Tons of folks said, I want to sponsor somebody. Well, now World Vision renounces its position, so what are you going to do? One step forward, two steps back. That's what systems of oppression look like. And then these are two other phrases. It might be less offensive if World Vision was honest about the fact that it needs donors instead of a concern for the spirit of Matthew 18, in quotes. Like, what would have happened if they were just honest? Like, if they exposed, like Jesus' parable does, that we're in a really tough spot, people. We want to help poor folks, and as soon as we did this, we just had 5,000 people take their funding away from us. What are we going to do? What if we even just started to have that kind of hard conversation together? A friend, Jeremy Smith, writes, thanks to World Vision, it's clear. Christianity is still aligned with the empire, responding to the powers, not the least and the lost. See, the World Vision fiasco, it brings to light the hypocrisy and the oppression that is all around us in the world, maybe like Jesus' parable did in its day. 5,000 evangelicals heard that a gay person was going to be hired in Seattle and stopped funding or sponsoring a child in sub-Saharan Africa. But then, some progressive evangelicals saw an opening, and they called their people to sponsor a child. They wanted to support World Vision's inclusive policy, maybe more than they wanted to help that child. And 24 hours later, the policy is reversed, so then what? What do you do in the midst of all that? Should the oppressive evangelicals take their money away from those children? Do the two have to be pitted against each other? Either children in poverty receive aid, or gay people in Seattle get jobs. What third way, if we really expose these systems and look at them. What third way is God calling us to? What might that look like? What if that's part of Jesus' point in this parable? That first we have to expose systems of exploitation and injustice, and only then do we begin to see that we're in this together. And God longs for us to be rooted in grace, to grow in faith, and to reach in love. God needs us to watch over each other in love, to build communities in which systems of oppression are unmasked and named for what they are. And then out of that, we create together lives of love and laughter, justice and humility. That was one of their taglines. Every child free from fear, says World Vision. What if every child, the poor one who's born in Madagascar, or the gay one who's born in Seattle? Or what if every child, the gay one that's born in Madagascar, or the poor one that's born in Seattle? What if every child is free from fear? What if God's longing is for us to expose those systems that keep us from that reality? How we get there is truly uncertain, but naming those systems in ways that Jesus just may have done in that parable, it exposes that neutrality is out of the question. That we are in this together, that God longs for us to find ways to live and move and have our being with love and with grace. How will we respond?
By the grace of the Lord, I've come a long way. By the grace of the Lord, I've come a long way. He's been my bread when I was hungry. He's been my company keeper every time I get a little lonely. By the grace.